Good afternoon. I'm Haled Janji, consultant for the English Montreal School Board. I have had the privilege to work with Georges Leroux in the context of the elaboration of the program that you know here, Ethics and Religious Culture. It is a great honor and a pleasure to present Dr. Georges Leroux, our moderator for this afternoon. Georges Leroux is an associate professor in the philosophy department at Université du Québec à Montréal. A specialist in ancient Greek philosophy, he is the author of countless publications on the Platonic tradition. His commitment to excellence in education is well recognized by his peers in academia. Georges Leroux is a member of Quebec's Académie des Lettres and has been visiting professor in several European universities. In 2005, he received the Award of Excellence in Teaching from Université du Québec. In 2008, Professor Leroux was elected member of the prestigious Royal Society of Canada. Georges Leroux is also an attentive and committed observer of Quebec society. Since 2006, he has been a key actor in the production and the improvement of the Ethics and Religious Culture program. Through his various writings and his involvement in public debate on social issues, Professor Leroux has actively contributed to the advancement of Quebec society. Let us welcome Dr. Georges Leroux.
For this very, very friendly presentation. I'm very happy to be here and very grateful to Spencer Goodall for having invited me to moderate this last hour of our meeting today. I think I might as well ask right away our guests to join me at this table, all the speakers, so we can go on with the discussion. The way we planned it, we have more or less an hour at our disposal. The way we planned it is we should have half an hour exchange between our guests on different matters, concern them, and then the rest of the time available should be for you, for your questions and discussion from the floor. As I was trying to avoid snoozing during Diane's presentation, I never resist a metaphor. I had this image, this vision of philosophers from the ancient times to a very near past knocking on our door and coming in this hall and listening to us. Plato, Aristotle, Spinoza, Hegel, Marx, all of them would have been astonished at our discussion. They would have been totally surprised that in such a short period of time, our civilization was able to move from an organic conception of religion that is inclusive of all the form of life, of all the way every individual in a community looks at life, to another vision that was so well described by Diane just a minute ago, that is something which is, if objectivity it is not possible, at least aims at some kind of objectivity with this wonderful wording of situated knowledge. This is our predicament. This is exactly our situation nowadays. And when we read, for example, maybe you remember, I think it would be nice for me to set the scene with this memory of this beautiful text by Hegel in his Phenomenology of Spirit, when he depicts the glory and the feeling of a sacrifice in ancient Greece. And he was, you know, a Christian, born Christian, and he longs, he thinks that being a Christian has separated him from the organic unity of the Greek people sacrificing oranges and apples on this beautiful sunny day in Athens. This piece of philosophy has always impressed me as an example that the questions we raise today, even if they weren't raised as such in the history of philosophy, were present. That is, Hegel had this idea that he might not having been born Christian. He might have been something else, someone who had could have been raised in another tradition, and that the distinction, if not the difference, between being Christian and being a pagan Greek is an object of reflection altogether. And as you know, when he was young, there's a lot of study today on the writing of his younger period, he tried to study more the Greek religion because he thought that Christian was sort of a decline from the glory of Greek religion. Later on, he came back to Christian convictions, and he died a perfect Christian. But this story is an example of the difference on an old conception of religion, that is, a conception that would be totally organic, where no teaching as such of difference is needed, to a conception in a situation that is ours, where this teaching of difference is absolutely essential for all sorts of reasons, an array of reasons, the most important of which is the one that Diane and Robert Jackson also stated, that is, in a multicultural environment, we absolutely need to cultivate the virtues of democracy. And when I state this expression, the virtue of democracy, I refer to Amy Gutman, whose book was discussed in all the works of the people around this table. So this afternoon, I thought that my task first is maybe to not to sum up the contributions that we heard. That would be a little boring for you, maybe, and then not really necessary. But I tried my best listening to these great, great presentations to raise a few questions for our guests. In this way, I will put myself in the position of the implied hearer here in this hall, that is, the universal person who tries to see what is exactly the question that was raised in this presentation. Spencer started with a presentation of the evolution of the system here in the province. His presentation was very precise, I would say accurate, and at one point he sort of left aside an aspect of which he is the specialist, and that might be the reason why he didn't talk very much about it. So my first question, I'll state all the questions and then we'll go to the people. Spencer works in the field of education. Now, the question is, This reform that we have here in Quebec will not succeed if our education faculties, and Diane raised that question too, and I know Bob Jackson is also interested in that, and also Isabel. It will not succeed, all these projects that we have will not succeed if we do not succeed in training our teachers towards all these very noble aims of teaching difference. Now, we have new programs here, not only the program for the students, but we have new programs in our universities. But these programs, these training programs, they had to be, you know, prepared, I would say, a little rapidly. And they include an ethics component as well as a religious culture component. And this is something very new. I'm from the philosophy department, where I taught 40 years and more. What I learned from that teaching is that my colleague philosophers had no interest whatsoever in addressing education students. Now we have to ask them, what do you want to do? Are you part of this venture, or you just want to look from the outside and look at the parade? The ethics specialists in our philosophy department, most of them, I'd say they're perplexed. They either are skeptical towards the combination of ethics and religious culture. Some of them say we'll never get through, that is, and the public debate gives them reason. That is, the public debate is always revolving around the questions of religion. No one talks about the fact that this program has, for an important part of it, an ethics component. So I would have liked to raise the question of what Spencer thinks are the main challenges today in Quebec regarding the training of our teachers. I understand fully that we can say that our teachers need to be trained towards religious culture. I travel all over the province, and everywhere I went when I met these teachers, there was an enthusiasm that I couldn't foretell. These teachers said, oh, if I was young enough, I would start a master's in religious science. I would, Professor Leroux, tell me where I can study Buddhism. I want to get expert on that. A real willingness to get involved. But none of them told me I want to get more into ethics. So the program has here a challenge of its own, and we have to look at it, really straightforwardly. Okay. Now, when I come now to the presentation of Robert Jackson, I must say, Robert, it's terrible for us to hear you.
Terrible for me to hear you.
I'll tell you why. You come from this wonderful combination of nations in Europe that is called Europe. And your presentation, as it proceeded, deepened my impression that Europe has now the key to that enterprise of religious culture education. That is, first of all, the energy from all the nations involved, Norway, Finland, the United Kingdom, all these nations have taken the challenge as a challenge addressed to them from their experience of diversity. But this would be very different from what we experience here in Quebec. Where it becomes different, and this is the reason why I address this question to you, is that Europe as a whole is diverse. For example, you mentioned the Belgian experience, which has opted for a communitarian model, whereby diverse religions have hours in the school a day a week or something like that. Germany also has a system of this sort. So I would like to ask you this. It's a long shot question. I understand from your presentation that Europe doesn't really experience a real difficulty on the level of principles. Everyone is for virtue. Everyone feels that difference has to be addressed, that democracy has to be protected and nurtured, that tolerance is a virtue. And the Toledo principles and all the groups that you participated in, they do the discussion very, very impressively. And that's the reason why I'm so impressed, because we have this discussion here in a sort of a, how could I describe it? Like, you know, it's like a cabin shut out from the outside. We're not part of Europe, and we're not part of the United States, and I'm not sure we're part of Canada on that thing. So it's a real issue. So I envy the European conversation, but should I envy, and this is the question, the diversity of practices on the ground? I understand there is no universal model. You stated quite clearly that you don't aim at such a model. You think that differences in education are there to stay. But at the same time, Europe, that's the long shot aspect, looks to me as if it was proceeding towards a form of unification of this aspect of education, because democracy is so important in the experience of Europe. And we could maybe raise side questions to that, because I don't remember if you mentioned Russia, because you mentioned Turkey, and it's very important. It may be strategic for the Turks to get involved in that discussion at this point of their history. But what about Russia, a great Christian nation, going back to its Christian roots right now, and at the same time not being part in the European spiritual space, cultural space, and all that. So the question here would be, how do you consider the evolution of nations, the difference of nations in Europe? I understand they resist the labeling of cheeses, but how do they look at education on the ground? Now, we heard Isabel, who comes from a research institution that we know very well here in Quebec because of the presence of Jean-Paul Willem, who is always here, and he is such a figure for us. So you're a new figure for us, and we welcome you, and we're very glad to have you here. But what I heard from your presentation was a confirmation of an enigma, the enigma of the French case. On the one side, you stated very clearly that France sticks to its republican tradition. That is, laïcité is there to stay. The Act of 1905, La Loi Combe, is something very important and never be reversed. At the same time, you describe the situation where the diversity of religions, the cultural diversity of the whole society makes a difference now. I mean, it's something that the government has to take into consideration. And so you present a model whereby religious education is done through the disciplines. It's not autonomous. It's something that history does, geography does, literature does. So I would like to ask you now, how do you judge that model? Does it have a future? Can we have a perspective on the way such a model might succeed? Because here we, it's an interesting question, of course, because the minister here, you know, his decision in June 2005 came to us as a shock. He said, we're going to have a compulsory course on religious culture starting 2008, and it's going to be a course. He could have said, well, we'll have that through civic education with history, or we could have that like in the French experiment. So it's interesting because no one here, we're all enthusiastic here, but no one is really convinced of the future. No one can predict how it will evolve. And we look at your experience, and so many of our philosophers' friends, Republican from the inside, you know, bone Republican, they look at us and they say, well, we'll give you a few years. A friend of mine with a few colleagues who hasn't stopped attacking the program since its implementation, has just published a book last week. Maybe you've seen it. It's called Happy Without God. And the book says something like, okay, let's look at this experiment. What they do is trying to proselytize, like Diane says. We'll give them a chance, but for sure they won't succeed because everyone will see that that's what they want. This is only a compromise with the bishops, or you know, all sorts of interpretations of the origins of the program. We all are here very interested. We keep our eyes on the French case. How is this going to evolve? And the Bray report was studied here very, very precisely. You know that. Now, Diane, your presentation of literacy and illiteracy was so full of insight and so complete and so filled with the philosophical assumptions that we all cherish, that is the democracy that we pursue. It is very difficult to raise a question for you that you didn't consider. I read your book very carefully, I mean this one, and I know how clearly you state the issues. Now, one thing that I was interested in is that in the work you do for the Academy of Religion, for the American Academy, you said, we have decided not to use the Toledo principles as a template. I didn't quite get the reasons why you didn't take it. We studied the Toledo principles too here, and it was a little late when we discovered that this process was going on, so we could not integrate them in our documents. But still, I'm not sure that we would have, for a reason very simple. It is that it has, let's put it very plainly, a premise of interfaith. And so we were advised not to go in that direction. So what is exactly the perspective of the principles that you put forward? I understand that this document is not ready yet. Your work?
Right, it's in progress. But yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I'm sorry I've been long. I wanted to just, you know, work my way through all that I heard. So let's start with Spencer. Could you have a quick word, Spencer, on training?
Yes.
How do you look at it?
I'll try to be very brief. When Jean-Pierre Prou came to speak to us at McGill about the Prou report, he wasn't even talking about the ethics part of it yet. He was talking about the teaching of religion. And I remember he said, he was looking for the expression in English, that teacher formation was le pied d'Achille, the Achilles heel of the program. That was going to be the big challenge. And adding ethics, obviously. And I would say, particularly at the elementary level, because they are not seen as subject specialists. They're seen as generalists. Whereas at the high school level, depending on the university, for example, the University of Montreal has a bachelor's in education in ethics and religious culture. So with their teaching degree of 120 credits, they'll have at least 50, 60 in the areas of ethics and religion. Now, before this, students in the elementary were going to either teach Catholic, Protestant, or moral ed. Now they're all in one class. I've taught them. And the number of credits that are compulsory are very limited. We're talking about 2-3 courses. Within that, they have to make some choices. So that's the challenge. Top on that, of course, is the fact that through no fault of their own, a lot of them are religiously illiterate and about their own traditions that they've come from. And I've been in the world of education a long time. Trying to get a piece of that 120 credit pie is very difficult because the math teachers want more math, and the French teachers want more French, and the English teachers say they're not well... So everybody wants a piece of the same pie. Already it's at 4 years after Cégep. It's 5 years if you come from Ontario. It's a long process. But I try to say to my students, we're not trying to make you religious scholars, but I would like you to be able to access religious scholarship or ethical scholarship. And what's encouraging today, I think, is that we have more access to knowledge than we ever had perhaps in the history of the world.
That's true.
And I think that, for example, I'm sure many teachers here are aware, there is a Learn website where this conference will probably put up there, where there are copyright clearances for wonderful resources for teachers in the area of ethics and religious culture. This is being fed constantly. The Dalai Lama's talk tomorrow to the students will be on that website and will be broadcast live. So I'm encouraged by these kinds. You know, our students are much more habile in the area of information technology than we are. However, I think we can give them some guidance in what is valid that's out there, that is valid scholarship.
And we have a good argument to answer our bishops, the Catholic bishops, who these last weeks raised their concern, expressed their concern about the fact that our teachers wouldn't be qualified.
Yes, I think that you have to give us some time. And I think they're not the only ones who have those concerns. We have those concerns. And I'm just going to say in passing, for example, knowing something about that, the teaching of English as a second language in Quebec, I think a lot of people would have concerns that our students sometimes go through 11 years of English and can't speak it at the end. So, I mean, there are other areas where there's a lot of need for improvement. But I think that there are resources out there. The big challenge is for faculties of education also, will they hire people in this area? Because there again, everybody wants a new hire to be in math or science or this area or that area. And I have a sign up in my office. It is what it is, you know. Ethics and religious culture is a petite matière. And it is what it is. And we won't get all the... I think one of the things with ethics, I was thinking when you were asking me, Georges, the Hippocratic Oath, you know, his first principle is do no harm. You know, I think there's something there. And I also think, I agree with Margaret Somerville, we do have some ethical instincts. We're not beginning at zero. If we're speaking to elementary school children about bullying, I think we have some instincts about what is proper behavior to another human being. So I'm hopeful, but I'm not at all unaware that the challenge is very great, especially with elementary.
So let's go to Robert Jackson with this question about Europe and the diversity of the experience on the ground.
The late Irish humorist Spike Milligan wrote a novel called Baku. And in that novel, he described a British army officer. And he said, the officer's immaculate uniform hid a mess of ragged underwear. I was talking about European institutions at the broad European level, like the Council of Europe, who exist to try to pull together a very diverse set of nation states, some of which have gone through dramatic and rapid change. Some have recent experience of violent conflict. And the intention of a body like the Council of Europe and the OSCE is to be visionary and to look for what is possible, but not to deny that the application of ideas is difficult. Of course, your portrayal of Canada, I think, is probably much more unified on the whole. I'm not going to go into this. Than Europe might be, at least in places. You mentioned the Russian Federation. Well, you see, all this, a state like Estonia was part of the Soviet Union. It is now a tiny and young state, actually. If you took its religious history, predominantly Lutheran rather than Orthodox, with an Orthodox minority, with an ethnic issue because of Russians who were compelled to go live in Estonia, and with a general climate in education of anti-religiousness, of actually both being anti-religious and not much interested in religion. Actually applying some of the ideas from Council of Europe or REDCO or whatever in that situation is a particular challenge. Now, one advantage of bringing people together from different European states, and it was a wonderful learning experience to work with our French colleagues, for example, is that people emerge who can see possibilities about how things might change in their own particular context. And I think in that REDCO project, we're just kind of having done lots of things together. We're now beginning to focus a bit on our own countries. And I know that this is the case. There's the new book coming out from Jean-Paul Willem and Céline Barraud, specifically about the French data and how the research might inform the French situation. We in England have got follow-up money to do a much more detailed study in England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, which incidentally I didn't talk about. I can't remember what Spencer asked me. He might have said, but he might not. Would you talk about religious education in the United Kingdom? That would be very complicated to do. The education system in Scotland is totally different from that in England and Wales. Mm-hmm. England and Wales. And Northern Ireland is different again. And when you say England and Wales, since the Welsh Parliament became devolved, Wales is gradually drifting away in various ways from England. So soon we'll be talking about England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales separately. So we have a study of young people's attitudes to religious diversity, which will include their attitudes towards the kinds of religious education that we've been talking about. That study is coming up. One of our REDCO partners was from Russia, from St. Petersburg. Wonderful ideas. He and his colleague, they're full of wonderful ideas. But it's not easy. I've been with the Council of Europe delegation to Nizhny Novgorod, used to be the closed city of Gorky, on the Volga. And there, some of the senior representatives of the Russian Orthodox Church made it very clear that their idea about human rights was different from the general human rights codes, and all human rights must be rooted in theology and so on. There is not, by any means, consensus. But I was so good to hear Diane say she was optimistic. I do feel optimism, actually, that, you know, one encounters so much goodwill in all of these different arenas and people wanting to sit down with people who will say, yes, but, or I don't think your view of human rights is the right one, or will this work, or whatever, to thrash things out and to try and take things forward. There are real differences between some of the southern European states. We had a wonderful contribution from Spain, from the University of Granada. But the power of the Catholic Church in Spain is very strong, and there can be. I mean, this is Diane talked about power, and when people have a lot of power, they don't want to lose it sometimes, and people can put things in the way of opening up dialogue. We certainly had some representatives from the Holy See really didn't like the Toledo guiding principles because they thought it was too gave too many people voices, and that Europe has a particular history and we should be, etc., etc. But what we need to do is to keep open the doors of dialogue. We haven't yet managed to have a conversation with those people. That's what we need to do. But I am optimistic. I think, and also I did mention the European Burgerland Centre and setting up databases and so on. One of the great joys of that Redcoat project is maybe 10 PhD students who are involved in it, who are tomorrow's leaders. You know, I think of the Estonian in her late 30s who will take over Pilar Valk's mantle. She's just finished her PhD on how some of these ideas really can be applied in Estonia. It's not going to be the likes of me that take this, but it's going to be the likes of them. And I think the more we facilitate networks and open things up, the more the possibilities there are actually for trying to devise some kind of practical situations that work. Just one final thing. I was invited to talk about the Toledo Guiding Principles at the University of Perugia in Umbria, Italy. And the grown-ups, the older people, didn't like it very much. And when the students started talking, they said, we've been dying to do something like this for years, and everybody stops us from doing it. We'd love to do this, but the structures won't allow it. Maybe in time they will.
Yes, I'm sure. Thank you, Robert. Isabel, now with the question of the French model.
Okay, so you asked me how I judge the situation in France after the Debré report.
Yes.
So, in fact, when Régis Debré was asked by Jack Lang to vote for this report, I was sent by the EPHE, École Pratique des Hautes Études, to help Régis Debré in the minister, because at the same time, EPHE was setting up training formation and shared interest in that question. So I know well how Régis Debré wrote his report. And he accepted Jack Lang's proposal, but said that he didn't want to write a report which is going to sleep on a desk. So he wanted a report followed by effects. But the corollaire, the consequence is that what he wrote, what the minister was willing to accept. And he didn't really have the choice of this question of a specific course or not.
Oh, I see.
We were told, and I was there, so I can really explain that. We were told by the inspector, I mentioned this corporatist
way. That was an element new for us in your presentation.
So the inspector were there, the minister, the representative, and explained that it was impossible to consider the fact of a specific course. Not a new body of teachers, no specific course. It was also
reasonable arguments, epistemological and so on, that I
presented,
and that convinced Regis-Le Bray truly, honestly, he was convinced by all that. But was he not, his records will be sleeping on the desk. That's perfectly clear. There's no debate in this question in the minister, not in intellectual reflection. So how I judge that? In fact, in European Institute of Religion, we are not on the same position on that question, intellectually, I mean. Some of us are convinced that it was the unique possibilities. Some, and I am on this side, are not absolutely convinced because, for example, in Catholic schools, there is an hour devoted to cultural, religious education. And as you may know, for the teenagers, it's somehow hard to give only confessional, denominational education, and it's more open, it's an overview of religious situation and culture. And it would have been a model. So that shows that it is not impossible to have 1 hour more, to have other teachers specialized on that question. And you know, Catholic school, private Catholic school in France, it is not a minority. It's an important sector of the education. And I mentioned the attempt in 1981 to erase the system. It was a huge strike demonstration in France. And people who go to these schools are not always Catholic. It's a choice of education, but not always a confessional choice. So this is another model, and he's not anti-democratic, and it's not as like, okay. So so there is many possibilities, but to be true, the question is not on debate for institutional reasons. But I mentioned that this situation is still in evolution. And just 1 minute more, I will add just the question of Buddhism and Hinduism. When we were preparing this report with Regis-Le Bray, we were told by inspectors on charge at those time that it was no question to mention specifically in the syllabuses Hinduism and Buddhism because it's too complicated, teachers are not well prepared, are not trained, and so it is, no. And now it is, now, just a few years later, new inspectors have other feelings, other ideas, and for the first time, last time was many years ago, but this year in the secondary school, there is two chapters, one of Buddhism, through the question of India, and also on China, and one of Hinduism. So it's a beginning. It's very small. Surely, for a specialist, it could be caricatural. I'm sure that it's not a very good presentation. But that shows that things that are supposed to be impossible can evolve, can move.
Yes, but I hear it's not a deadlock. Even if it looks from the outside that it could be a deadlock because of the constraints, it is not.
Yes.
It can evolve from the inside.
Yes, but the question of a specific course on religious phenomena, I don't see that in a short time, to be really honest, because of many reasons, and also because of this epistemological reason. That is, if it is part of the normal courses, literature, history, what exempts that situation? You know, the example I gave, the model of Catholic school, the problem is this is out of the curriculum, so there is no exam. And for children, if there is no exam, this is less serious, so they are less involved. And last word, this is always for all new ideas nowadays in France, this is the same answer. For art history, histoire des arts, it's more than art history, the government choose the same the same answer, that is not a specific course, full discipline,
full
spectrum, and then it is in global examination.
Thank you very much. Now last, Diane.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the question. I'm going to be very brief because I'm very eager to hear your comments, questions, and hear from you all. The Toledo document, again, is an excellent document, and I certainly don't mean to in any way represent it in a negative light. I think it is, we ended up deciding that it was one, probably the best, actually, that we came upon, which we categorize as a consensus document. And it helps to further a language around civic understanding of religion. And the players that were present appropriately then came together to create a consensus document. So again, religious leaders, legal experts, and then also teachers and religious scholars. We found in our consideration of the document, certainly we're referencing it in the AAR guidelines, but because it's moving in that consensus way, it didn't address the fundamental framework from a religious studies perspective, which is why we decided to create this document, because we didn't think in all the literature out there that there was anybody looking at these questions from the scholarship of religion perspective. And we felt like that was an appropriate contribution we could make, again, to complement documents like the Toledo document. But to recognize that it was a specific, it came at it from a very different perspective with some different assertions we were able to make because of the nature of the makeup of the group that's articulating.
Yes. Well, it will certainly be very interesting to compare these documents.
Yes.
When your document comes out.
Yes.
And try to discuss it. Maybe anyone of you would like to interact with what the others said, or we could...
Could I briefly comment
yes.
on
yes,
what Dan said?
Yeah,
just to clarify, I mean, one of the problems with producing some of these documents like the Toledo Guiding Principles is as soon as you've done it, story over. You know, that the budget for dissemination is extremely limited. There was a meeting in Washington. There was planned to be one in Canada, but it just didn't come off, and then the budget was finished. A document like that needs quite a lot of explanation. Actually, there was no representation of religious leaders, and there was no representation of religions. It just so happened that some of the people who were lawyers or educators or whatever were from different religious and, I have to say, non-religious backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
It depends what you mean by interfaith. Because I mentioned by name this morning Barry Van Driel. Barry is an atheist,
yes.
But he would say, you know, it's very important to get the situatedness, as it were, of the different actors involved in this. We weren't actually setting out to produce a methodology
right.
at all, but rather a set of principles from which people might start if they were going to produce a methodology. I think it's a wonderful turn to have scholars in religious studies. The American Academy of Religion group, for example, and in Europe we have the European Association for the Study of Religions. There's a young woman, a German called Wanda Alberts, who's now teaching in Norway, but her commitment too is to find a religious studies methodology. What cheers me no end is that I can remember the time when religious studies scholars weren't the slightest bit interested in education, and we heard a little whiff of that from other people as well. There was quite a shift. I remember going to the International Association for the History of Religions conference in Durban in, I think it was 2000, and I was deeply impressed by the fact that so many of the younger scholars were saying, it's no good doing religious studies for its own sake. It needs to be socially relevant and socially useful. And there was the stuff being applied to gender and sexuality and to education. And I just welcome this tremendously. I'm looking forward very much indeed to seeing the document that you produced.
What I get from what you just said is that it might be very helpful in different countries if we could discuss the Toledo Principles and your document. And since there are not so many documents of this sort, I'm not sure I can even mention one. So it's very important at this stage of the evolution of religious education that these documents, for example, the Toledo Principles states, gives very, very good arguments for continuing training for the teachers. Mm-hmm. That is,
yep.
So it invites the states to support the training for the teachers, even in the schools. Okay. So we have time now. We've been a little long, but we have people. Just give your name and go on with your question.
My name is Malek, and I just wanted to first thank all of the panelists. Your talks were really enlightening and gave me a lot to think about. And I wanted to touch on two of the statements that Dr. Moore presented as views teachers should strive to impart upon their students. The first is that two different people can have two conflicting truths that are both right. And the second is that students should see their own understanding of either their religious tradition or religion more generally presented responsibly and accurately, but not exclusively. This objective seems problematic, however, given the fact that students in the classroom, and indeed even many of the teachers leading those classrooms, will have very deeply held religious convictions that conflict with today's ruling moray of plurality. So my question is, how then do teachers deal with the fact of these convictions, either within themselves or among their students, that they've got it right, or even more controversially, that they're truly following God, while at the same time attempting to produce members of society who can not only practice tolerance, but are also religiously literate, and can therefore function effectively as democratic citizens in a multicultural environment?
Great, great, thank you. Excellent question, and very well stated. Briefly again, it is imperative, and I am sure many of you, and all of you probably already practice this, but it is imperative that when addressing questions of religion in a context of illiteracy about religion, that you begin right away, and this is what we promote through a cultural studies method, is that you help give students the language of the distinction between a devotional understanding of religion and the study of religion, and that the goals then are understanding about religion, not to encourage people to change their religious perspective. So you have to lay it out in the beginning very clearly so the students recognize that what we're doing in the study of religion then becomes a very different enterprise than what they probably associate with religion or that they may anticipate will happen in the context of a classroom. So this issue then of people who have firm religious convictions, that's what I meant about if you lay that out and be really clear with students that they will see their, depending, again, I want to be clear, we as teachers, I think, are always attentive to who our students are in the classroom, and we want them to feel that they are seen and heard and respected, whether that's race, ethnicity, religion, whatever. So when I spoke about the need for teachers to be attentive to their students in the classroom, and that objective to say that you need to see, that they need to believe and then experience that they will see their interpretation accurately, respectfully, but not exclusively. The not exclusively is what you right away explain to students in the context of their study. So again, it's laying it out, it's helping give them the tools, and then I won't say that there aren't going to be controversies, but in my own experience and the experience of my students, and I think Bob's studies throughout Europe are showing that, again, rather than, contrary to all the fears that students are going to be confused, that they're going to then change their religious traditions, they welcome this. They're incredibly sophisticated. You know this. You're the teachers. Students are incredibly sophisticated about these questions. They talk about these questions all the time. We need to give them tools to do it more responsibly, I think, and give them tools to help understand those differences. So, again, I think it's if you lay it out from the outset, then even people with firm convictions can recognize that that this is not about proselytizing them, nor are they in the appropriate place to then proselytize others. Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Dan Siri. I noted there was an interesting tension, if there was any tension, in the discussion today, despite, I think, the overall commitment to sort of an open secularist approach to religious diversity. There's this tension about whether that's exclusive of faith-based perspectives as part of the formative conversation, or in the case of the Toledo guidelines, sort of bringing them in right at the ground level and including them in that formative process of thinking through what an open secularist approach to religious literacy means. And I wonder if I just put a little bit more pressure in the direction of inclusion in terms of the concrete situation that we're facing in Quebec with legal debates over the ERC program. There are traditional, John Rawls argues that there are traditions, different reasonable comprehensive positions, so open secularism would be one of them, but arguably you could argue from Rawls's point of view that yes, there's also reasonable religious positions in a liberal democratic society. There's open Catholicism, open Judaism, open Islam, you know, open Buddhism, traditions that want to deeply anchor their faith in a commitment to liberal democratic values of respect, tolerance, recognition of others, and so on. And shouldn't those theological voices, those informed theological voices, be important partners at the table? And Diane was saying, well, no, not at the table, but shouldn't they be at the table?
Let me jump in quickly, and then I would love to hear my colleagues respond also. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have religious voices in public conversation and religious voices in the public sphere. I precisely would argue that that's both impossible, nor is it a goal. What I'm saying is that when we're talking about establishing curricula to teach about religions in the schools, that the scholars are the ones who need to be able to make those determinations about what is going to be taught and the nature of how we're going to teach it, because that's what scholars are trained to do, and that the sensitivity to the diversity of religious voices and the encouragement of encouraging our students to participate in democratic citizenship in context of their religious traditions should be part of what we're promoting. But I'm talking about how do we teach about religion? Who should be the people to make the determinations about the sources we use for that? We have, again, in our context in the U.S., many, consensus kinds of documents that say that will include religious practitioners and religious leaders. And that's what I'm saying is that in the academy anyway, we feel like, again, not to dismiss the importance of those voices or the legitimacy of their concerns in relationship to larger civic issues, but in the teaching about religion, because in a non-sectarian context, it's the religious studies scholars who have the language and the resources to understand what needs to be taught and suggestions for what to use.
Robert, maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Yeah, sure. Of course, I work in a rather different system from Diane, you know, which has had church-state partnership right back to the beginnings of state education in 1870. Post-1997, well, if I say that there were different kinds of Christian schools from very early on within the state system, so you've got to think of a system where by 1944 there were what we then call county schools, we now call community schools, which are the fully state-funded schools, the kind of situation that Diane has been talking about. Alongside those, there were also Church of England schools, Roman Catholic schools, and from 1944... some Jewish schools, mainly funded by the state, but a little bit funded, buildings, some sort of 80% of the building costs and maintenance costs, none of the staff costs, by the religious body. When the new Labour government came in 1997, they felt that there was an injustice. I mean, the Labour policy had been to get rid of all these schools. Something that will be extraordinarily difficult to do. And in the end, they changed their policy completely and said, actually, what we need is more of these schools to be just and fair. And so we now have Muslim schools that have the same status, mainly state-funded, not all that many of them, but some they're called voluntary-aided schools. It's a voluntary relationship between the religious body and the state, and state aids these schools. We have two Sikh schools. We now have one Hindu school in these categories. We've got a Seventh-day Adventist school now. Now, these schools have to operate with the national curriculum, but they are allowed to have their own form of religious education. Now, over recent years, part of the public debate has been, you know, one voice has been, we shouldn't have these schools because they're teaching their children to be separate. Yeah? There has been a big push from these schools to try to be inclusive. So exactly what you were talking about has been going on. That is, schools have been trying to find a theology of inclusiveness so that they can treat other religions with some fairness. Now, very little studies have been done of these schools, not too much study, but we've just finished, and just writing up the report now, of a national study of what textbooks and web resources and so on are being used by teachers to teach about world religions in English schools. And the remit we were given by the government was to look at every type of school. So we had to look at these schools alongside the community schools. Now, what we found was that some of them are actually doing it really very well. That is, they have a form of religious formation or nurture for their own children. Some children who go to the schools are not from that background. But all the children in the school will have a kind of religious studies approach to other religions. And the two are kind of combined together. Now, whether that's right or wrong in an absolute sense, I wouldn't want to say. It is just there. And it did seem to us that some of these schools, given the circumstances they were in, were actually doing quite a good job.
Does that answer your question, Daniel? Okay. Isabel, would you like to comment on that? No. Okay, we're going this side.
I think I'm hitting the same thing, but I'll try to make it more relevant. Starting with the American experience of Professor Moore, the separation of church and state, I guess, is, you know, the rule, but they're starting to bring in religious education. And I really endorse your interfaith approach, which Pope John Paul also endorsed. I'm wondering whether the conservatives will say, well, you're being relativistic. Therefore, you're caught in this bind of being interfaith and multicultural, but on the other hand, you're giving the students sort of an objectivity like a scholar would have and saying, well, you don't have to decide, and therefore you're not really giving them a religious education, which the conservatives would not be happy with, in my opinion. So I'd open to the panel as well.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Let me respond and see if I'm responding to your question. First of all, the U.S. context is distinct from the context we've heard. Our independent schools are not, that can be either religious or not, are not supported by the government. So we have public schools that are supposed to be non-sectarian, and then we have independent schools that are not governed, they're governed in the sense of whether they're accredited or not, but they're not funded by the government. So independent schools become the opportunity for faith-based traditions to offer education through their own experience. You use the language interfaith, and I would say interfaith again would be a third prong. I think the study of religion requires, it's not objective and cold, it really does require students to wrestle with and look at diverse representations of traditions and diverse representations of the way that religion plays itself out in public life, historically and in a contemporary way. So this actually ties back into this question of ethics and religious culture. I don't know how you teach about anything without having ethics be part of it. I mean, education is about values, and we're promoting values all the time, and those represent then certain ethical assumptions. I hope we're as conscious as possible about what those are. That becomes an important dimension. But in that way, this is not an approach that says, it's very different. It's not saying, okay, again, we're only going to learn about, you know, this, quote, objective dimension of religion, five pillars, 10 commandments. I call it the arithmetic version of religion, you know, 5, 10, 4. So students are confronted with these complex questions. And in my experience, in middle and secondary education particularly, and then now I have an 11-year-old daughter, so I'm also picking it up from her perspective, they are incredibly capable of addressing these kinds of questions and eager to do so, very eager to do so. And our role, I think, is to help give them both a place to do that with, again, an informed set of tools that they can do this, again, in an informed way and in a respectful way. And so I'm not sure, I hope I'm responding to your comment.
Well, I was wondering whether you can you just be open?
Because we have about five other people there.
What's that? Oh, would you be open to criticism by the conservatives by saying, well, you're not presenting an answer, you're just presenting a bunch of choices which my child cannot.
Right. Again, I would if part of the concern then is the assertion or the judgment of relativism. I don't think that's the case because we are rooting this in a larger language. There are values to pluralism, right? That's not relativist. There are values that we're saying we value pluralism, we value communication, we value information about pluralistic cultures. Those are value judgments, and not all religions are going to be happy about that. Mm-hmm. I don't believe, my concern is that we need to be explicit and upfront. And this is part of my concern with some of the language in the U.S. context is we talk about saying, well, it's okay to teach about religion as long as you're neutral. Well, what does that mean? Neutral. Nothing in education is neutral. And it shouldn't be, I don't think. So there's legal language, and then there's the actual, what are we doing with this? And so there is a value that some religious conservatives are not going to be happy with, and I think that's where dialogue comes in to say we need to have these conversations to promote the safety of everyone to live and flourish in a multicultural, multi-religious democracy.
Thank you. Time is running short. We're nearing the end of this meeting. We have one people on this side and three others there. I wouldn't put myself in the position of, cutting the on the edge, but maybe we could use a different strategy. Just have short interventions from your part without having our guests answer one after the other, and then we could conclude with a few remarks. Would that be okay with you, people? Okay, let's go with you. This is 1 minute each.
Fantastic. I have two questions, but the first one's very short, and it's for Dr. Moore, and a straight yes or no answer would suffice.
Okay.
The U.S. CCB, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, has developed a curricular framework for interreligious and interfaith dialogue for a senior elective course. Has the AAR taken a look at this document?
Yes.
My second question, thank you.
Very good.
So we addressed the concerns of teacher training quite extensively in all the seminars, and I want to thank the panelists for all your wonderful insights. But this is a practical question from a school administration standpoint. How can we assure that school administrators actually staff people who have qualification in teaching these courses? I come from Ontario, where religious education is still publicly funded, hopefully until after our next election. But essentially, people are staffed in religion like how back before they were typing was the course that everybody had to do as their penance. And now it's teaching religion is your penance. How can you address this issue?
Okay, well, we'll keep this your question in mind. Next.
Mireille Sivales, Université de Montréal. I would like to address a question to the Professor Jackson. You've told us in your presentation about very different and interesting projects about religious education at international level and European level, related with human rights, intercultural education, and freedom of religion, and so on. But what I would like to know if we have a precise idea of the effect of these recommendations on national policies, and for instance, on the curricula of different countries.
That reaches my question before. But thank you, Mireille. Did you get the question? Yeah, Robert? Okay.
My name is Lynn Moreau. I'm from the Paroisse Saint-Praxède in Sherbrooke. And you could call me perhaps a religious leader because I prepare the religious classes that are given at church. And my feeling is that when somebody is solid about their own beliefs, it is easier to accept learning about other cultures, but how can we raise consciousness of the general population to the importance of religion today? Because in Sherbrooke, they had a press conference with Monseigneur Couture, and media didn't show up. We can't reach the population. How do we achieve that? Okay, I don't know who can answer. Can anybody answer?
Okay, so your question is not addressed to anyone specific. Okay.
Anybody who has an idea.
Okay. Thank you for your question. The last is Konrad.
Konrad Munch. I was involved in the last few years in coordinating the training of trainers and school boards for ethics and religious culture in the English schools. And I would like to say to you just today that it's just wonderful to be here. And it's nice to also to see that there are members of the staff, the teachers from school boards are here, trainers of ethics and religious culture, spiritual animators, consultants from school boards, administrators, members of the Ministère de l'Éducation et Loisirs et du Sport. So I just want to reiterate the fact that it's here. What I've noticed in the last few years is a close collaboration between the universities and the Ministry of Education, and it has created something so nice as ethics and religious culture. And this event here, I think, also shows that the collaboration continues. So I would like this collaboration to see it to continue. It's a good thing, I think. So I think Spencer mentioned that also at his opening remarks. I would like to also ask a question about teacher training, however. We've heard today lots of thoughts and ideas were expressed on ethics, religion, diversity, education, and teacher training. What about dialogue and critical thinking? How is that being dealt at the education faculties or in universities now and for the next little while? Thank you.
Thank you, Konrad. Okay, we'll just wrap up this by coming back to your questions. Who wants to answer? I think Robert would like to answer the first question.
I can't remember what the first question was, but I'll answer the question that was buzzing around in my head, which is from Mireille.
We'll go back to the first.
Okay. It was about if you get these international policy documents, how do you convert that into activity at the national level?
Yes.
Most of the projects that I was talking about, they've only just reached their culmination. It's a very short time, for example, since the recommendations from the Council of Europe project have been available to governments. I have to say that I did meet somebody from it changes its name every week. It's now the Department for Children, Schools and Families. It actually used to be called the Department for Education. I'm very nostalgic for that. It's now Children, Schools and Families. But the guy from there didn't even know that the Council of Europe had produced these recommendations. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens. It is up to
actors to ensure that these things are known about and are discussed, and that's part of the remit of the European Burgerland Centre. Mm-hmm. But, for example, at state level, on that Council of Europe project, various people who've been involved have gone to bodies like in England. We have the Religious Education Council of England and Wales, who are extremely interested in that. There have been presentations to them. They meet regularly with government officers, and I hope, confident that there will be an impact on policy there. But to shift from research to policy, to shift from discussions to policy is not straightforward. You have to work at that just as you have to work at the research.
Diane, would you like to address the question about how do we recruit, how do we make sure that the people that we train are trained correctly and that
yes.
Remember the question?
Yes, I do. Thank you. I think that becomes we need some clarity about what we feel like an adequate baseline foundation is. We need to be able to help lay some standards for teacher education in this area. And currently in the U.S., we don't have any imposed standard for that. I think there are, you do here in Quebec. I know that the European Union has different dimensions in different contexts. I think this is the case for any issue in any teacher program. How do you make a determination about the adequacy of training? I think there's for religion. I think it's not only to have the religious studies background. I think there's a certain disposition that's also required that will allow for a clarity of thinking and an inviting atmosphere and a sensitivity to the diversity of expressions that are going to be present in any given school or any given classroom. So again, I think these are local concerns. Local constituents need to make those determinations, but I do think having some articulation of what is required is critical.
Now, there's that's still that question standing from the person who works at parish level. The question was, how do we get our issues, how do we make them public and have the media come to us? I think the challenge is the same for all of us, either for policymakers or for public issues. The type of issue that you represent here, if you want to go public, of course you have to work your way to the media, that's for sure. I don't think any one of us would have a straightforward answer specific for your situation. I'm very grateful that you're here, since we tend to forgive maybe rapidly that and easily that the advent of this course, ECR program, has to stay complemented with the efforts on the ground at parish level. Mm-hmm. And this is very important that people think in the parishes, and I never stop repeating it, that now that we have this course, we're not the ones to go on the street and parade it, and, it's different paths. No, religion is organic and living everywhere where it lives, especially here in Quebec in the parishes.
I'm just going to conclude. I'll answer Mark's question because I don't think we answered it about.
Well, I thought that Cova had a very wonderful concluding remarks at the beginning. We should have hired you.
But Mark was saying, how do you get to people who have the knowledge? And I'm just saying that. I was trying to think of it. The parents have a lot of influence, I think, too. And French was not always well taught in Quebec in the English schools. And the parents started insisting. I mean, I've been involved with teachers, almost accent-free teachers they want, I studied French in the States, and I always remember Mark Twain who said, I speak French, but I don't understand it. It was more of that. But I think if parents who are more and more educated hear teachers saying some nonsense about religion, and they're going to, the schools will have to put on their big boy pants and hire people who can teach it properly. But we are really, really out of time and over.
And so now I think before I leave him, the microphone. I want to act here as your representative, as the representative of our guest, to thank Spencer and his committee with a wild applause for his work. This includes really the studies faculty, the faculty of education, and all the people at McGill who were so warm. Their welcome was really appreciated, and we've had a nice day, I'm sure, for that. Now Spencer wants to say a few things to you.
Before my dean says the final thank you, I'm so thrilled of our guests, and I must give a special thank you to Maddie, who's been saying to me, don't worry, calm down, everything will be okay. And Ruxalor, who saved us with his computer today, and Malik, who is here, so many other people. My friend Jim Sullivan, who is so involved with the visit of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who worked on this, and he said, I feel like I printed the wedding invitations for my own wedding, and I'm not going, you know. Nothing here would have happened today without the support of my dean, Hélène Perrault. Hélène made the resources available for me to be able to work on this, and without that support, I would not have been able to do it. So, Hélène, I am, to use a religious phrase, eternally grateful, and I thank you very much.
Chers amis, quel privilège! Ce matin, le vice-recteur à la recherche a ouvert ce colloque en nous disant qu'il n'avait jamais eu une semaine aussi occupée, aussi intense. Moi, je vous dirais que dans mes 25 ans d'activité professionnelle à McGill, j'ai rarement vu une telle densité d'échanges intellectuels, d'énergie, pour un sujet que Spencer appelle une petite matière, mais en fait qui fait couler beaucoup d'encre. Et je pense que ce que l'on a vu aujourd'hui nous prouve que c'est un sujet quand même d'actualité pour lequel, effectivement, j'avais beaucoup d'intérêt. Je pense que vous aurez apprécié, autant que je l'ai fait moi-même, la richesse des tableaux qui nous ont été présentés aujourd'hui sur des sociétés nord-américaines, européennes, diverses de par leur composition démographique, leur trajectoire historique ou leur position sociopolitique, mais abordant tous une même problématique par rapport à la religion, la culture et l'éthique. Je suis persuadée que nous avons eu droit aujourd'hui à des billets de première classe, et je pense que c'est un privilège immense pour moi d'être ici aujourd'hui pour en témoigner. Upon receiving the advertisement for today's symposium, a colleague of mine within the university was surprised and asked, you're the Faculty of Education, why are you organizing this symposium? I paused, and I responded, why not? But I was really thinking, why is he asking this? It seemed pretty obvious to me that as a diverse faculty of education like ours, which advances knowledge on a wide variety of human development throughout the lifespan, be it cognitive, emotional, physical, psychosocial, how could we neglect to consider the cultural and religious perspective? And I think what we have heard today in all of these talks convinces me that we cannot dissociate these aspects. They're all connected, and that it is very appropriate that those who are tasked to transmit and transfer this knowledge be involved in organizations such as in organizing such a symposium. Now, I have the floor, and so I will use the privilege of this floor to probably make a comment here that I'm going to use as a situated knowledge from my field of scholarship, which is clinical exercise physiology. Now, I will allow myself to do so
on two grounds. I was going to do it anyways. But then we saw that not only was there the French paradox that we already know about the French having less heart diseases despite eating the foie gras and knowing it's probably the red wine, but also another French paradox in the way that they actually approach the issues on religious education. So allow me to take you back to my world, where I've been struck here by the fact that the word tolerance is used quite a bit. Now, in my world, when we do clinical exercise testing, we are testing tolerance. We are testing tolerance for a symptom. We are testing for the limit at which the insult actually can no longer be sustained. And it seems to me that that's a bit of an unfortunate choice of a word for what we are trying to project here. And I would probably volunteer, for all it's worth, the word acceptance. And if I carry you through my field a little bit further, I would tell you that in my field, one of the solutions to this intolerance is really rehabilitation. But there is no right or wrong way for rehabilitation. These are tailored. They are tailored to the needs of the person, to their environment, to their individual choices. And so, obviously, the more choices, the more the research has advanced our understanding and has enhanced the menus of these tools and of these choices, the more we can cater to these intolerances. So I think what we've seen today is an enhancement, an extension of la table d'hôte that our guests here have provided us with. And I think it is through these exchanges and through these collective reflection that we will advance and that we will be able to contribute to the respect that we would like to be seeing in our societies. So finally, let me take you to my words of thanks. The symposium today all started, as Spencer was saying, about a year ago when the reform was starting to be implemented in the schools, and Spencer was forever being called by the press to react on an item or another. Now, I was an incoming dean. I had been in place for 2 or 3 days. I was not going to answer the journalists. And so, of course, Spencer would have to be taking the calls. But that prompted my curiosity. And I kept asking questions to Spencer. And I guess he found the best answer. He said, okay, I'll give you an answer, and this is what you're getting today. So at McGill, we pride ourselves of providing students with a rich environment for learning. And I would think that if there is such a thing as a McGill currency, I think that if there ever was a recession and an economic downturn on our McGill currency today, the rate just went up quite a bit, and that the richness of our environment has just been enhanced greatly by the contribution of great speakers that were here today. I'd like to therefore thank Robert, Isabelle, Diane, for accepting our invitation, facing jet lags, and I will include George in Georges Leroux in that, because I know that he just flew in last night as well, and accepting to come and be here with us and contributing to this, I think, very insightful gathering. So thank you very much for accepting this invitation. And I think we can applaud them. I will, of course, say merci to Spencer. Spencer accepted to take the lead in setting this symposium at the same time as he was continuing all his function, teaching the students, and at the time serving as Associate Dean, Student Life and Learning, and now having accepted to serve as ombudsperson for the university. Now, of course, he had to let go of the Associate Dean. We can't have him have too many jobs because then we won't have a job. So, Spencer, thank you very much for doing this. I can't forget Maddie Zamani. Maddie has been in the office, the right hand for Spencer. I think we've put her through a test of sleep deprivation through this seminar. So, Maddie, thank you very much. Malek, thank you. You've been helpful as well. All of you, thank you. Thank you for your insight. Thank you for being here. And thank you for your questions. And I hope we will have a part two on this. Thank you.